Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. Two interviews up on today's show. First, in a few minutes, a chat with John Talbot, a former investment banker and author of a couple of books on the housing bust, and most recently, of Obamanomics, How Bottom-Up Economic Prosperity Will Replace Trickle-Down Economics. I'm skeptical. His argument is a little bit thin in the details, but you can make up your own mind. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, the author and activist. Most of our conversation was inspired by her contribution to a collection called Red State Rebels, Tales of Grassroots Resistance in the Heartland. Before that, some news. The housing crisis and the associated fallout continue to dominate the economic headlines. Earlier this week, we learned that Freddie Mac, along with Fannie Mae, one of the two quasi-public companies that hold over $5 trillion in mortgages, reported a much larger-than-expected loss for the second quarter, $821 million. The bad news keeps coming, and usually it's worse than most people expected. My guess is that this pattern is going to continue, because while Freddie and Fannie have reported large losses, they're still not fully recognizing the extent of the problem. Were these entirely private institutions, they would be in bankruptcy court. By any conventional measure, they're completely broke. But they're not private institutions. They've got a federal guarantee, which was always implicit, but was recently made explicit. The government has little choice but to bail these institutions out. Foreign investors, notably Asian central banks, owned hundreds of billions of bonds issued by Fannie and Freddie, and any sign that they were at risk of default would be seen as a default by the U.S. Treasury itself, which would almost certainly instigate a financial meltdown of horrific proportions. I'm always skeptical when people say we're in or near another Great Depression, but a Fannie or Freddie default could well bring one on. As I've been saying here for weeks, it's almost certain that it's going to take scores of billions, maybe hundreds of billions of dollars in federal money to get out of this mess. I've also been saying that this probably won't happen until after the election, because I'd rather talk about tire gauges during campaigns than anything consequential. Since this money is almost certain to be spent, what should we get for it? Certainly not an attempt to return to the old status quo, which guaranteed big profits for shareholders, fat interest payments for bondholders, and bulging pay packets for managers. These institutions should be properly nationalized and used to fund affordable housing, not speculative bubbles. Existing shareholders should be wiped out, and management set packing with little more than the office supplies in their desk drawers. In not quite breaking news, we always knew that income in the U.S. was very concentrated at the top. And now we have some fresh evidence of how tightly concentrated it is. Well, not exactly new, it's 2006 data, but it is just out. A report from the Institution on Taxation and Economic Policy, ITEP, a D.C.-based data shop, analyzes the IRS's newly released data on incomes in 2006. The IRS data is particularly useful, since it covers the very rich, which most conventional surveys don't. The residents of Beverly Hills and Park Avenue just don't like to talk to census takers. Thanks to this data, we know that in 2006, the richest 1% of the population had 21% of all income, not far from twice the share of the entire bottom half, 13%. Okay, that's 1 2/3 times, not twice, but that's close enough for radio. In some states, the distribution is far more lopsided than the national average. The state where the rich have the biggest share is Wyoming, where the top 1% has 31% of the income, more than 2.5 times as much as the bottom half of the population. My home state, New York, is number 2 in this dubious competition. The richest 1% has 29% of income. But because we have more poor people in the Empire State than in Wyoming, the ratio is actually slightly worse. Connecticut comes in 4th and California 7th. In most of these states, the rich are far from paying their fair share of taxes. ITEP points out that of the 10 most unequal states, 4 lack an income tax, and 3 have a flat or nearly flat tax. New York and California do have a progressive tax structure, meaning the rich pay a higher share of their income than the non-rich, but both have cut top tax rates over the years, which has both reinforced pre-tax inequality and left both states with big structural budget deficits. At the other end of the list, the most equal states are, in order, West Virginia, Alaska, Iowa, and Maine, mostly poor and rural states. In all four, the top 1% and bottom 50% have roughly equal shares of total income. That's what passes for egalitarianism in the USA, a 50-to-1 ratio. Let's take a musical break and we'll be back with John Talbot. Some of Money, Success, Fame, Glamour by Felix de Housecat versus Pop-Tarts. Well, pursuits of things other than that profane quartet may have been discredited, but the culture of money isn't looking so good these days either. For more on that, let's turn to John Talbot. Talbot is a former investment banker with Goldman Sachs whose latest book is Obamanomics, How Bottom-Up Economic Prosperity Will Replace Trickle-Down Economics, just out from Seven Stories Press. But since his previous two books were about the housing bubble and bust, I thought I'd start by asking for his thoughts about all that. John Talbot. All right, let's start by taking a survey of where we are. You've written a few books about the housing market. How far do we have to go on the downside, do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's the old joke about how far a bear can walk into the woods. I mean, we're about halfway there, and we're walking our way out now. But for a lot of people, that's a very disturbing story because there are individual cities like Miami Beach, San Diego, condominium market, Las Vegas, Phoenix, that have seen 30% declines in their condominiums, 20 plus 25% declines in their homes, and to tell them we're only halfway through is quite disturbing. But in 2003, I wrote a book called The Coming Crash of the Housing Market. People laughed, so I got mad and followed up in February 2006 with Sell Now, The End of the Housing Bubble. And in that book, I lay out over about...
That was pretty right around the peak, pretty much, you called it there.
I called pretty close to the peak, so, you know, some luck and some smarts, but I don't know what the ratio is. But in that second book, you know, I used a formula and said we had to get back to 97 pricing, that we had to get back to where prices were before these banks started doing all this crazy lending. And I published by city what that meant, to get back to a kind of a current inflated value of a 97 price level. And it meant the number one worst city, Santa Barbara, had to come off almost 58% in value. It meant that most of Florida and California had to come off some 50% on the coastal cities. And it meant the nation as a whole had to come off about 25%. And if you notice, that's just about exactly, we're about halfway there. The coasts are off 25%, the country's off about 14%. So a lot more pain to go. But you know, and the reason's pretty obvious, right? That these people were lending so much money that the defaults we've had to date are just 2005, 2006, and 2007 mortgages. These are the mortgages that were most recently written at the highest prices. Well, we've got to go back further than that. And I think last week in the newspapers it said the prices were back to 2004 levels. They clearly have to come back to 2000 levels, and if I'm right, come back to 97 levels.
So your explanation of it is what happened with the banks, the lending situation, because, you know, if you look at the fundamentals, household formation, population growth, construction costs, there's nothing that can explain what happened to housing in those 10 years. So it's mostly on the financial side, you think?
It was all financial side, yeah. And in the books, what I try to argue, they kept trying to say that buyers were irrational, and I never liked that word. You know, that violates my economics training, that people could be irrational, although we all know they can be. But they're not crazy, and they might spend $1 million for a house, but someone probably lent them $990,000. So we do our craziest, most irrational things with other people's money. And these people, I think, realistically knew that they had a huge upside if their markets continue to increase at 20% per year on their principal amount, even though their down payment was 1/100th of that. And on the downside, they were going to lay it off in the bank. Not too much different than what the Bush administration is doing now with their problems, right? On the upside, Fannie Mae executives take $100 million in bonuses out, and on the downside, they lay it off on the taxpayer.
Someone asked me a question in a radio interview a little while ago. It's a very good one, and it's not always easy to answer. When people talk about all the losses that we're going to suffer in this housing bust, where'd the money go? Who's really taking the hit?
Well, it's a brilliant question, and I heard it first from my good friend Dick Roll, who's written over 100 academic papers and is often mentioned as a potential candidate for the Nobel Prize in economics. And he's at UCLA's Anderson School. And when he heard the title of my first book, he said, "John, where'd the money go? Isn't this just a wash? I mean, so what if a bank lost an investment, someone didn't pay them back? Someone got the money." So if you're going to talk about impacts on the economy and overall negative impacts causing recessions, et cetera, from his perspective, it looked like it was a complete wash. And what I tried to explain to him is mathematically that might be correct, but you were forgetting that geographically things were happening outside the United States, that there were holders of these securities outside the United States that were out beyond our economy. And more importantly, temporarily, we took all the benefits over the 80s and 90s and the early of this century. We spent all the money we were lent. We refinanced our homes. We bought the boats. We bought the cars. And now the banks are having the losses. And so it's not necessarily in the same year. And what's important is it's bank equity losses. So they're going to stop lending, and they're going to stop lending 10 to 15 times the amount of equity they've lost, because that's how leveraged they are when they make loans. And so they're going to cause us to go into a recession, because they're not just going to stop mortgage lending. They're going to pull back to protect their capital and protect their solvency. They're going to stop restaurant lending, retail lending, all, you know, car lending, student loan lending. I mean, I'm a big believer that banks cause business cycles rather than the other way around.
Yeah, I think there people are just looking at the direct effect of the housing bust in the economy, but this credit effect could be very dramatic in the coming years. This could linger for a considerable period of time if banks really do get that tight about making fresh loans. This really could have quite an impact in the economy for years to come, couldn't it?
Yeah, I think what we're going to see is three phases to this thing. We're halfway through the housing portion of this and the housing prices, and we all know how debilitating that is. We've seen the tip of the iceberg on the credit problems, and now you read in the paper maybe 100 banks, maybe 200 banks might become insolvent. And we have our Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson suggesting, and our president suggesting not to worry, up to $100,000 the FDIC guarantees these payments. But those two problem areas are of such a magnitude that we're talking $5 to $6 trillion decline in housing real estate values, $2 to $3 trillion losses to banks worldwide. And I told you there's a 10 to 15 multiplier to that as to how much they'll have to pull back in lending. It then leads to the third leg or the third problem, and that is recession. And yeah, I'm predicting a very, very severe recession. Not a depression because of Bernanke. Bernanke has written academic papers on how to respond to crises, and he's responded quickly. Unfortunately, part of the response is he's got to spend taxpayer money. And the way he does it without congressional approval is he prints money. So he's been printing money. The European Central Bank's been printing money, and the Bank of England have been printing money as fast as they can to give to their banks to prevent their banks from becoming insolvent, all because of U.S. mortgages. If you thought the world didn't like us before with the Iraq war, we ought to hear what they're saying about us in Europe now for having sold them this crummy 65-cent paper and calling it AAA and basically destroying their banking system.
I noticed the Congressional Budget Office came out with a report the other day estimating the possible losses to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would be about $25 billion to the government. This is reminding me of the savings and loan crisis when they started with those small numbers and it kept getting bigger and bigger. And then you knew things were getting close to an end when people started throwing around trillion-dollar estimates. But we're nowhere near at that point when we're talking that kind of money. So do you think this is going to follow that trajectory?
It'd be wonderful to go back and look at those early articles on the SNL crisis, because I'll bet you they were numbers right around $10 or $20 billion, I'll bet you. And we know it ended up north of a half trillion. It may have been as large as a trillion. And it's exactly what's happening. And I can just give you a couple of quick numbers to convince you. First of all, the headline in the New York Times was the Congressional Budget Office estimates a $25 billion loss. Well, when you got in and read their report to Congress, that's not what it said. It said there was a 50% chance there'd be no taxpayer support needed, a 45% chance that something in the $25 billion range would be needed, and a 5% chance that it might be as large as $100 billion. Well, I'd love to meet the guy that wrote that report, because that means he'd be willing to give me 20-to-1 odds if I were to bet him that it would be more than $100 billion. And that would be the easiest money I've ever earned. And here's how I can convince you. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac sit on $5 trillion of mortgages, $1.6 trillion on their books, and $3.4 trillion in guarantees. They are non-diversified. They don't hold any other assets. They just hold U.S. mortgages. They thought they were diversified because they thought all real estate was local and all real estate problems were by neighborhood and city. And they found out this time, quite a shock, that there's such a thing as a national real estate depression in pricing. So with $5 trillion of mortgages and house prices declining 25% nationwide, by my math, that means something like the collateral could evaporate by $1.2 trillion. Now, I don't know exactly of that $1.2 trillion in decline in collateral value, how much of that actually defaults. But I know that people are not going to continue to pay $200,000 and $300,000 mortgages when the house next door just sold for $150,000. They're going to do what's called jinglers. They're going to put the keys in the mail and mail them back to their bank. And Fannie Mae is going to see it all because of their guarantees. So the number is not $1.2 trillion. If you wanted to pull a number out of the air, it's somewhere between $200 billion and $600 billion. But it's a huge number. It's a huge number. And it's just embarrassing that the CBO would come out with a number like $25 billion.
Well, if you look back at the precedents, the Scandinavian banking and housing real estate crises in the early 90s, their numbers were like 5% of GDP. So 500, 600 seems like a reasonable place to start, the estimates. I'm speaking with John Talbot, a former investment banker and a visiting scholar at the UCLA Anderson School of Management, and author most recently of Obamanomics, just out from Seven Stories Press. Let's switch the subject to how do we get out of this. You're very optimistic. You've written a book, Obamanomics, if Barack Obama wins, which certainly seems better than even chance right now, that he will reverse some of these sad economic trends that have culminated in this housing bust and recession. Why do you think that is? What about Obama's economic policy will turn this around?
This is not going to be easy. I mean, this situation is getting worse each day. The government's solution, and it's funny because the Bush administration and Cheney and Paulson have prided themselves on being free market advocates, they're doing just the opposite of any free market solution. They're having the taxpayer and the U.S. government come in and guarantee everything and print money to fund all losses and to prevent any reasonable size investment bank or commercial bank from even having the possibility of failing. So it's the old story. On the upside, it's pure capitalism and no control of executive pay. And on the downside, it's socialism and let the government and the taxpayer bail us out. So these are very, very, very large, very significant problems. I like to remind people that $1 trillion is a million bags of $1 million each, almost incomprehensible. And this is a multi-trillion dollar problem. Whoever wins the White House, this is the worst presidential handoff in history, and I haven't even mentioned the wars around the world, global warming, Social Security shortfalls. Just this immediate problem, which is housing, mortgage, credit, and recession, is going to be a mess. And if the current administration were continuing for another 4 years, I can't paint a dire enough scenario. It just so happens, I believe, Barack Obama is the right person to address this. I believe his persona is just what's needed to reinstill faith and confidence in the markets. I believe he's held up to be an honorable man. And it just so happens he gave a speech at Cooper Union to an audience of Wall Street executives 3 months ago, and he came out boldly and courageously and said, "Gentlemen, the gig is up. You've had free run of the markets here for the last 7-8 years. You've literally taken hundreds of billions of profits. It's over. You're going to be re-regulated." They defeated Glass-Steagall in 1999 by contributing $417 million to your Congress. They're going to reinstitute rules. There's not going to be fraudulent mortgages. There's not going to be a complete separation of commercial banking and investment banking activities. At least there should be more of a separation. They're going to have capital adequacy ratios for banks. They're going to insist that people, when they buy homes, at least have some skin in the game, that they have some reasonable down payment in the purchase of a house. And what I found fascinating about the speech was, you know, Barack Obama is not a finance expert. He doesn't have higher level training in finance, which means he had tens or maybe hundreds of people come to him and suggest what they thought the solution to this crisis was. And he had the wisdom to listen and select what I think was the best solution of all I've heard. So that instilled in me a lot of confidence in the man.
He is having no trouble raising money from Wall Street. Paul Tudor Jones threw him a big fundraising party a little over a year ago in Greenwich. He's getting more money from investment houses than McCain is. Are they doing penance by this, or they think that maybe he's really just doing this for public consumption, and once he gets into office, they're going to get a free pass?
Yeah, he doesn't take any money from corporations. If you send him a personal check with your little small family-owned business and it has ink anywhere printed on the check, it gets returned to you in the mail. He won't take any lobbyist money. He said they're not going to be a part of his administration. But in the modern world, the internet has sites that accumulate not the corporate donations, but the sum of all the donations of a particular employer. So Goldman Sachs has lots of wealthy employees, and when you aggregate up all those employee donations, then you see kind of a snapshot picture of what the Goldman Sachs employees want. Well, I can tell you during the primary season, all the commercial banks, all the hedge funds, all the investment banks, all the mortgage companies, all the real estate companies were squarely behind Hillary Clinton, and she led in each of those categories. The only categories where employees aggregated up to be a total that Barack surpassed Hillary were universities, retired peoples, and music and film companies. So if he's an advocate of concentrated wealth, those seem like the most harmless areas I can find. You're right. Looking at it today, in every category, he's out. People are contributing more to him than John McCain. But that's a result of John McCain's ineptness as a candidate, I think, more than any quid pro quo. I don't see Barack Obama entering into any quid pro quo with any company, because that's the basis of his fight, is he's going to stop a lot of this lobbying activity.
One of the more serious problems affecting our society, and you write about this in the book, is the tremendous increase in inequality over the last three decades. What do you think Obama's going to do about that?
Well, it's a big problem. I mean, the obvious thing is Bush gave a $2 trillion tax cut to the richest 10% of the country. The Wall Street Journal today reports that the richest 1% now controls a greater percentage of income than ever in recent history. I think it's grown from 10% up to 22% of total income controlled by the top 1%. Oh, and by the way, they're paying the lowest taxes they've ever paid. So, you know, we passed the laws, Bush encouraged us to, and now it's showing up in the numbers. But that's just the most obvious thing. I think there's a deeper economic story to tell, and that's globalization. Globalization, when you cut through it, and the reason why most economists are in favor of it, is David Ricardo said that trade is good for everybody. Well, what he meant was trade is good for countries that enter into trade, but he never said that everybody within a country had to participate equally. As a matter of fact, individual groups within a country could be harmed by trade. And that's what we're seeing. We've seen enormous wealth created in America from trade with China and India and other countries, but there's no question the working man, the union movement, has been severely hampered. The working man has not seen a pay raise in 30 years, even though his productivity has exploded. And the reason is globalization put him in competition with low-wage Mexico, non-unionized China, low-wage India. You know, there's no way he could have benefited. Regardless of his productivity, any type of labor market would have had those gains accrue to the owners of the businesses. And that's exactly what we've seen. So that creates enormous wealth disparity. No, Obama's not talking about turning off globalization or cutting back on trade. But he recognizes that there's losers in this game. If we have hard workers who we've put in competition with people not only of low-wage countries, but low-cost-of-living countries. They're living well in their native homes, where our Americans are forced to live in a very high-cost environment. So it's totally unfair, and that's what Barack wants to introduce to trade agreements. He wants to introduce some environmental protection and some worker protection, and then, of course, consumer product safety, so we're not importing lead-painted toys and concrete pills designed as malaria pills.
What about anything, any kind of income redistribution? Is he going to, as in the words of the guy in All the King's Men, soak the fat boys and take some of that and transfer it to the poor?
Yeah, you know, my personal wish is I hoped he would, but, you know, everything's relative, right? I mean, I'm not crazy enough to think you can tax your wealthiest people at 90, 95% levels and have them motivated. And if you add up all their taxes, I mean, not to feel sorry for the rich, but if you add up all their taxes now, you know, they're approaching paying over 50, 55% to the government. And that includes all their state and local taxes, capital gains, et cetera. So, you know, again, that probably won't bring a tear to many of the eyes of your listeners, but there is a limit to what you can do. But we're certainly not at that limit. I mean, the most important thing that Obama is strongly for is making sure the inheritance tax survives. And here we're talking about people with $4 and $6 million and up inheritances. And it's crazy. And no one even raises this. They, you know, the conservatives call it a death tax. That's not the issue. The issue is, are we going to be a country like the monarchies of Europe, where wealth and privilege and status is conferred by blood and birth? Or are we going to be a meritocracy, which is what America has always stood for, where hard work and effort and education determines your future success? I haven't done the analysis, but I can turn on the computer and almost guarantee you that a regression analysis predicting a student's future success, the number one most important variable is the income of his parents. And that's not an America I want to live in.
Well, that's always been true, I think, and the social science does confirm that. And parental background actually is a stronger influence in even school quality, according to the social scientists. What do you imagine an Obama would do on taking office on January 20th next year?
Well, the nice thing about the book is, you know, and writing books in general, it gives you a chance to step back and look at big picture ideas, which unfortunately you don't have a chance to talk about in 30-second sound bites on talking head television. So I encourage the readers to get the book and read through it, and you will see that he does have a very long-term perspective. I don't know if it's an African perspective he gets from his father. It's also kind of a laid-back Hawaiian attitude that they're, you know, people that work for him now, he'll tell you the first thing he says to them is there's not going to be any drama in this campaign. We're not going to get upset by things that are written about us, by things employees do to us, etc. And so they call him No Drama Obama. So the book is very long-term perspective. I think Obama has a very long-term perspective. What's sad is he's being thrown into this forest fire of a recession and a global financial crisis. So he's going to have to deal with that first. I think it's the only thing he should talk about for the next 4 months. I mean, I think it ought to be the content of all of his speeches. You know, I remember James Carville signed to Bill Clinton in 92. It's the economy, stupid. I mean, people out there, that's all they want to hear about. So it's going to be his major impetus. He will have working groups that get after all these other issues because they're huge. He will get going on education. He'll get going on Israel and Palestine. He'll get going on global warming. But he's facing a real crisis on day one. So he's going to be tested by fire. The analogies to the Kennedy administration can't be lost, you know, where he walked directly into the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And that was John Talbot, formerly of Goldman Sachs and now a visiting prof at the UCLA Anderson School of Management. Like I said, I'm not persuaded that Obamanomics is going to be all that great, or different even. Just the other day, Obama proposed giving $4 billion in tax breaks and other assistance to the auto industry to retool and make more environmentally considerate cars. Over the last year, GM and Ford together have lost more than $4 billion a month, so I'm not sure what this $4 billion he's proposing would do. I did think it was worth listening to what a financial and economic expert, even if he does have an idiosyncratic pronunciation of Fed Chair Ben Bernanke's name, what such an expert, who is also an Obama enthusiast, would have to say about what kinds of economic policies he might pursue should he win. Well, this expert has remarkably little specific to say about how Barack Obama would make this great transformation in economic policy. We'll see. And as for his claim that Wall Street favored Hillary Clinton, there's just no evidence for that. I mentioned the fundraising party that major hedge fund honcho Paul Tudor Jones threw for Obama in April 2007. Note that date, quite early in the election cycle. A visit to the excellent Open Secret website reveals that the pattern of contributions to both campaigns, when classified by industry, are very similar. the two candidates shared 16 of their top 20 sectors. Oh, and Wall Street much prefers Obama to either Clinton or McCain. Obama's haul from the securities industry is 42% higher than McCain's so far in this campaign season. Clinton's was just 16% higher. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 on your FM dial, or WBAI.org on the web. This is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Thanks to all of you who pledged and made our summer fundraiser a success. If you've yet to pay, please do. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Was the Talking Heads, Burning Down the House, from way back before lots of you were born, I'm sure. I'm not recommending that as a strategy for homeowners with onerous mortgages, though. And now an interview with the author and activist Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Roxanne has written a series of books about her political and personal history, from growing up poor in Oklahoma through her 1960s activism and her political engagements in the present. She now lives in San Francisco, which is a long way from Oklahoma in several respects. But she hasn't forgotten the heartland by any means. She's got an essay in Red State Rebels, a collection about political troublemakers in the heartland, edited by Joshua Frank and Jeff St. Clair, published a little while back by AK Press. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Welcome, Roxanne. Members of the cultural elite living in coastal states like me hear about the red states, we think it's nothing but bigotry and ignorance. You take exception to that cliche, don't you?
Yes, it... You know, there is a kind of provincialism in the cities that then accuse the countryside of being provincial. But actually, it's people who've traveled across the country, which the several of the authors in Red State Rebels have done recently, and I did last fall. It's really impressive, the level and intensity of local resistance movements, and they seem to automatically include being against the war, even though they're not specifically organized. I mean, some are, like the Iraq Vets Against the War, are in many, many states. Of course, most bases are in red states in the South and in Oklahoma.
And most military, or many members of the military, come from there too.
Yes, and the majority of the military comes from these states and from rural, you know, or small towns and rural areas. So when I was in Oklahoma last fall, I visited Fort Sill, which is a base where those who desert or whatever, like Mejia, he was incarcerated there. And so people had organized. Now there's Iraq Vets Against the War. And it's so impressive how I think it's courageous, because you can get knocked off pretty easily in the red states for being, say, gay activists. There's a lot of pro-gay activity and organizing. A lot of our environmental things in Oklahoma, which is mainly what my essay is about, there's the Green Corn Organization, which is their it's not the Green Party, but it's their environmental organization. And they're in every little town in Oklahoma, and it's very impressive. I think the internet, I have seen changes, because even though I live in San Francisco, I keep going back to Oklahoma, and I've gotten really involved in the last 15 years with some young people who some of them aren't so young now that I started working with, but they brought in other young people. The advance in the internet, you know, has really accelerated their networking and connections. And with the, could call it the outside world, you know, with other things that are going on. And I think there's a movement out there that most coastal urbanites just don't know about. And sometimes when I get really kind of discouraged living in San Francisco, everyone's always saying, oh, why can't we build a movement? We have these serious meetings. How can we organize people? And I don't feel that kind of pessimism because it seems to me there is so much that's percolating and that's much deeper, you know, at a deeper level than, you know, I'm a veteran of the 60s and I used to go throughout the country. And the anti-war movement as such, I mean, in the polls, people turned against the war because mainly they thought it couldn't be won. But the 60s movements, other than some of the worst aspects like drugs coming in, really didn't penetrate very deeply into, you know, these what we now call red state areas. But now I feel like there's a real changes, you know, especially in this younger generation, and a lot more multiracial, you know, not so separate. In Oklahoma, there's, you know, a very large, about 15% of the population is Native American, but they don't have land base that was taken away, so they have sovereignty. They have some land that they've reclaimed, but mainly for, you know, like a square mile or something for tribal headquarters or a casino or something. And then there's about a 10% African American population. So it's a, you know, an overwhelmingly white Scots-Irish descended population, although there's a large Vietnamese community that was relocated there that's very interesting, and descendants of immigrants like Bohemians and Germans and all. But it seems to me that across the young people are much less tending toward racism, you know, or bigotry than in the past, even though they still mostly go to church and they're Christians and everything.
Well, I want to get back to that in a moment, but you know, I think the coastal elitist perception of the heartland, always was there, but it was deeply reinforced by the 2004 election, and people saw those election returns and that solid band of red in the middle of the country. Is that not really a fair representation of the complexity of life there? Or are we just being very superficial and looking at all those blocks of red and missing a lot?
Well, you know, I had a real argument with people on listserv I was on. I thought they were being very bigoted. They wanted the northeastern states to withdraw from the Union and let the red states have it, you know. But the thing is, just like the rest of the country, very few people vote, and they're mostly older people who vote. I mean, that's just the reality of national, you know, presidential elections. And so I think you get the old guard in these states that have controlled for so long. Like when I was growing up in Oklahoma, the right-wingers, a family called the Gaylords, they still control all the media, but now the media, you know, you can go to the internet, and they don't control that, but they control the newspapers, the television stations. The same family still controls it, you know, down the descendants and the museums and everything. And so you have this elite in those states that have a very strict control, are very racist. And throughout the South and the border states, you've had that. And I think people know that everything is rigged. I mean, they assume everything is rigged, politics is rigged, and they just don't get involved. So I don't think it really reflects the population so much as just a kind of lack of faith in electoral politics really changing anything for them or anything else. People are more involved, and there's a lot of excitement about Obama. As there was about Jesse Jackson, by the way, in 84 and 88, that was a big window of opportunity to organize in the red states that I worked with people back there, but Central American solidarity was very strong through the churches, especially the Catholic Church. And the Catholic churches tend to be more liberal in these right-wing, Protestant-dominated states than they are in San Francisco and New York and all. So they're always a good force. They're a good force right now against the Iraq War. So I just think also we have to realize that John Kerry so represented that elite, and then he was portrayed that way very skillfully by the Bush administration as an elite kind of guy. We never used the term Yankees in Oklahoma. We just said a northerner, Easterners. He's such an Easterner.
He also came off like a walking corpse, too.
I know, and his windsurfing, and he wasn't against the war. So why should anyone vote for him? It was kind of, I did, because I just, the lesser of two evils is the kind of, bottom line. Or join the union if there's a union there, even if it's a bad union. But most normal human beings don't think that way.
That could get you in trouble in some quarters. I'm speaking with the author and activist Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, a contributor to the volume Red State Rebels, Tales of Resistance from the Heartland, just published by AK Press. You mentioned this a couple of times about a generational change that I think a lot of us may be missing. So could you bring that out a little more?
Yeah, I do think there's this younger generation that those of us who are older, I think, have a really hard time comprehending the bad and good, results of electronic communications, and the speed of communications and how this has penetrated young people really in all parts of the world. I work in the international indigenous movement, and it's just amazing how really remote areas in the Andes or in the Amazon, that each person may not have their cell phone or their computer, but there is one in the village, and it's used for communication. And I don't think we can quite comprehend, and I'm not saying I can, but I just know that it's producing something beyond what we can imagine now in terms of how the vision, for future and what these young people will expect. And I think the Obama campaign really studied that. Obama himself, I think he's very smart and very on top of this, and himself is a kind of first generation product of it. And I think it's being manipulated, for sure, to bring in, to kind of attract and bring in a mass multitude, to behave in a certain way and support him. But I don't think that's the end of the story. A lot of people are worried about that, these kids getting captured. I don't think we have any parallels or precedents, but I see it in really everywhere with the younger people. We're talking about now, 13, 14-year-old kids who I can sit down and have a conversation with, and like one grandnephew of mine, I kind of hit my head, I said, this guy's only 14 years old, and we're talking, he hadn't gone to college or anything, and we're talking about an array of things that I would talk with, with my colleagues teaching, at a level, his comprehension of the world. And it makes me very hopeful, just because I think we've been in a very deep counter-revolutionary period. You could call it a backlash to the 60s. Really trying to kill and snuff out every single possibility of resistance, every little pocket of resistance. even the hapless SLA people, they put them back in jail, you know, in the early, about 6 years ago, 5 years ago. And it's like these Panthers who are still in prison and all that. There can't be any sign. And of course, they tried to do that around the world. And now you have Latin America, you know, a whole new trajectory in Latin America that no one quite knows. It's unexpected, and where will it go? And I think it's the same here. I think there's something worldwide, and the repression of it is really brutal, but it doesn't seem to be working, you know. And I guess I don't feel as anxious about, well, we can't manage this. There's a kind of control thing I find among my my radical colleagues, my leftist colleagues that I work with, and it does disturb me. We don't have a mass movement against the war, but I think there's some reason for it, and maybe things just aren't going to, you know, work quite the same way as they did in the past, because I do see things going on, and there's this sense we on the left don't have any place to intervene or to have an influence or to control, you know, in some way how it's going to go and have an overarching thing. And I'm not as worried about that as a lot of people are.
You live in a city that's even more of a cartoon of being out of touch and elitist than the one we're sitting in right now.
Right.
But how can people in places like this connect with folks, the red state, heartland folks, in any meaningful way? I mean, we can't just parachute in and say, you know, we're here to save you. Obviously, that's
right.
Patronizing and alienating and stupid and wrong. But how do we hook up?
Well, you know, I've been doing a lot of thinking about this. I have a friend, James Tracy and Amy Sonny, who are writing a book on the, you remember the Young Patriots, the Patriot Party in Chicago, the young Appalachians that SDS went in to organize on the North Side. Todd Gitlin and Nancy Hollander wrote a book called North Side about it. They were involved in SDS, the ERAP programs, and they call this JOIN. And I met with them and worked with them some with the Appalachians in Chicago, some in Cincinnati and other cities, and then these Okies out on the West Coast. And As I observed the SDS people, who were all urban, you know, Todd Gitlin and Rennie Davis and these people, they were really, really sincere. But I think there's a kind of, class is such a unexplored aspect of life in the United States. It's sort of an unmentionable. And I think the way things have gone with, Gitlin and others can condemn identity politics, and I'm sure they would rather see class politics. But I don't think anyone knows what it means in the United States. And when they think of the working class, that's, you know, blue collar or industrial working class. And then there are these people like the Appalachians who were jobless. They had run out of the mining, you know, the mining industry. They had gone to the cities. They're jobless. So they don't really fit within the working. I mean, they are working class, but they're unemployed. And so I think the class, it's really important. It doesn't mean that people can't cross class lines to organize, but that you have to be class conscious, you know, that you can't just consider yourself declassé and go in and say, I have no class affiliations, without exploring class consciousness that you're taking with you. It's partly cultural. It's partly, which includes an access. Because I grew up working class and really poor, I'm always conscious of it, and I still...
It's in your bones and muscles, really.
Well, not just that. I always feel lacking, you know. I'm always learning something new just because I only started learning about anything that wasn't, you know, in this very small world when I was 20 years old. And it's like I'll never catch up. You know, I still can't make out, like, Greek people are always referring and writing to the Greeks and the Greek gods and these stories. I can never get those stories straight. You know, you have to be raised on that stuff. You know, what? Now, which one was this or that? You know, and it's very alienating, even with a doctorate in history, to read, you know, open a book. And
our president went to Andover, and I don't think he could get that straight either.
I know. It's not just an education. But it's being raised to the intellectual class here, really being raised to these things are like mother's milk, you know, you don't even have to go. I know people who never went to college who were raised with that kind of intellectual setting. That's such a privilege, you know. And poor people don't have access to these privileges, so it's almost as if there's a different language, you know. And I think the lack of class consciousness in the organizers who went in to Mississippi. You know, one thing I've in reading this book, and I'm writing the foreword for it, so I've, you know, really been doing a lot of thinking about this book on the Appalachian, the organizing. There, the people who went into Mississippi, you know, when SNCC kicked out the whites, and say, you know, that was really a class thing. It was defined as white, but all the whites had come from, you know, this elite. And some of the blacks had come from fairly elite black backgrounds in the North compared to the poor, but they still were either first generation to go to college or whatever. They weren't from this sort of, you know, upper middle class intellectual, or many of them from red diaper babies who had access to all this, you know, knowledge of how to organize and everything. So to me, what was not defined was the class conflict involved. And I'm not saying there wasn't also a racial aspect, but that we don't, I know in the women's movement, it came up around, always around how to incorporate women of color. And yet I think about 80% of it should have been conceptualized as a class, you know, a class differences. Because I felt it in the women's movement as a class. I mean, I'm part Indian, but I wasn't defining myself as such. But I felt the class difference, yeah. So I think that's the main problem, and I think people on the left need to have, I don't mean to, you know, dress up like workers and act like workers, which a lot of the SDS people did, you know, try to talk like the Appalachians and everything, but to really become, you know, conscious of those, you know, really a kind of bigotry against working class people, unless it can be characterized as, oh, that's black culture, or that's Puerto Rican, or that's Latino. And the real test is when they get to whites and they can't say that, then they just see it as bigotry. But that means they're also not dealing with other groups of people, taking into consideration class, and it's kind of racist, you know, because they're defining that person completely by their color and dealing with them, and not with, you know, with the economic class and class consciousness. So I think that's the main thing. And in Oklahoma, I'm working with young people. They're usually just their generation is just out of the working class, and they've been able to go to college and stuff. But they're close enough to it to remember and to, you know, develop a group of organizers. They already feel pretty comfortable, you know, and they're not that far away from. But to not try to declass themselves, that is, in a way like I did, you know, I tell the story of being, you know, sort of feeling like to be accepted on the left, I had to lose my accent, I had to stop dressing well. I had to stop wearing makeup. I had to either cut my hair or let it grow long, or, you know, whatever was.
Don't want to be seen as white trash, right?
Right, yeah. And not to do certain things and to fit in, you know, because the left has a kind of cultural, a culture in itself, and it's sort of, you have to pass certain tests to be a part of it, you know. And you'll never get working class people because they won't feel, well, they hang on, like Obama says, to their guns and religion and security, and they're not going to let it go very easily, you know, hang on to their family and their ways because it's not safe out there, you know, and I can assure them it's not really. You know, I don't know how I persevered, honestly, on the left. I was just determined. That's what I was going to behave that way and learn that, whether anyone wanted me to or not. But I remember this woman, Lynn Wells, who was with SOC, the Southern Student Organizing Committee, that was sort of the SDS of the South, and she was a red diaper baby, just telling me up front in 1969, when we had talked, and in my background, she says, you know, I don't trust you. I don't trust that you'll stay in the movement. Wow, thanks.
That's a way to build solidarity.
Yeah, right.
All right, I think we have to end it there. Thanks for joining us.
And that was Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, the writer, teacher, and activist. Check out her website, reddirtsite.com. That's reddirtsite, SITE.com, all one word. Named after her Verso book from some years ago, Red Dirt, Growing Up Okey. And check out the collection Red State Rebels, edited by Joshua Frank and Jeffrey St. Clair, published by AK Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. And let's go out with this, a sum of Sexy from Metric back in 2003. I don't know what's happening to me. There's something sweet and tuneful about this. I guess I'm getting soft in my old age. Oh well, till next week. Bye.
Lonesome for no one.